She left Pakistan's terror but was killed by America's. Today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. A Pakistani exchange student is killed in America's latest school shooting, and many Pakistanis are dumbfounded.
People understand terrorist violence. They understand that kind of thing. They don't understand children taking up guns and going into the schools and shooting each other. That's unheard of. It doesn't happen here, and nobody can understand it.
Also, if President Trump does end up meeting North Korea's Kim Jong-un, the stakes will be very high.
If the summit fails, then you really have no place to go in terms of diplomacy. I mean, the summit is the top, right? It is the very pinnacle of diplomacy, and if it fails, the only thing after a summit is a cliff.
Those stories and a lot more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It is Monday. It is good to start the week with you. And as I think about what we've got for you on the show today, identity is a thread that weaves through the next hour. From an Egyptian soccer star to the guests at the royal wedding, to the novels of Junot Diaz and how readers and writers relate to him and his stories in this era of Me Too. Identity, but we begin with the school shooting in Texas last week and the identities of some of the victims. As always, their stories make you stop and think. There is the tragedy of the substitute teacher who was trying to make ends meet by picking up extra hours in the classroom to pay for her dying husband's medical bills. She was killed, her body later discovered by her son, a police detective dispatched to Santa Fe High School. 9 others were also killed and at least 13 injured. One of those who died in that Texas shooting was an exchange student from Karachi, Pakistan, Sabika Sheikh. Author Bina Shah is in Karachi. She says 17-year-old Sabika Sheikh jumped at the chance to study in the U.S.
She was selected to join a very prestigious program which takes kids from Pakistan and sends them to high schools in the United States for a year. This is under a program called the Kennedy Luger Exchange, and it's worked out by the U.S. State Department. Lots and lots of kids from Pakistan have been on this program, have spent a very happy year being hosted by American families, going to an American high school, and they come back to Pakistan all charged up and really ready to take on a very bright future. Sabika was one of those kids, and it just turned out very differently for her.
Yeah, apparently a very prestigious program. I've been reading about Sabika's reaction when she found out she was chosen for it, and uploading a video onto YouTube saying she was over the moon and jumping around like a madman.
I was squealing, jumping like a madman. I was like over the moon. I wrote a diary entry that day because it was really special for me.
Some of the descriptions of her room, I mean, her books of Roald Dahl stories and Khaled Hosseini's books. Is it unusual that a Pakistani family would allow a teenage girl to make this kind of trip?
Most Pakistani families know that an opportunity like this comes along once in a lifetime. And Pakistanis that are really excited about being able to get their kids to see a part of the world that they may not be able to take them to, financial constraints or what have you. So this represents a really great chance for them to get exposure to a completely different country. So most families are so overjoyed when their kids get this opportunity. Girls have gone as much as boys have gone. But that is an extra sort of step for a Pakistani family to send their daughter abroad so far away. It just shows you how much they trusted the program, how much they trusted the people that they had sent their daughter to. And really, it just shows how ironic life can be. Pakistan is always perceived as unsafe for children, especially with Taliban attacks on schools here. So this was just not something anybody could have expected.
How did her family in Pakistan find out about the school shooting?
Well, her father had just broken his evening fast. It's the month of Ramzan here all over the world. He had just broken his evening fast, and suddenly he started seeing news reports on TV about the school shooting and realized that it was the very same school his daughter was attending. He called his host family to find out if his daughter was okay, and they said, "We will get back to you." When they called him back, they told him the worst news that any parent can ever hear in their lives, that she was gone.
Yeah. What else have you learned about the reaction from the family?
They're in shock. They're in mourning. Their daughter was everything for them, and she had only about 20 days to go before she was to head back. She'd already told her parents what food to prepare for her, you know, very typical Pakistani food, biryani and samosas and pakoras. She was missing her mom's home cooking. They were looking forward to welcoming a daughter home around the time of our festival, Eid, which marks the end of the month of Ramzan.
What about Pakistan's public? I mean, how are they processing this? And you've lived in the States. Are you getting questions from Pakistanis about, you know, what it's like to be in this country where these shootings happen so frequently?
The whole nation is just absolutely devastated, shocked by this happening. Our perceptions of our own country's safety and security versus our perceptions of the United States and the larger Western hemisphere as relatively safer are all turned upside down. However, thanks to world media, we do know about the problem of school shootings. Every time one of these things happens, we get to see it here on cable news, CNN, BBC. We have it all here. So we're aware of this problem, and we, you know, Pakistanis can't understand. They just can't understand why there are no gun control laws that would stop school shootings from happening again and again and again.
Violent crime is very high in Pakistan. There's a high murder rate, but gun ownership here is off the charts when you compare it to Pakistan. If you ask Pakistanis how they see violence in the U.S., what is likely to be their response?
It would be very mixed depending on the amount of exposure that they've had to the United States. If you've traveled there or if you've spent time there, you have relatives there, you do know that there's a problem with gun ownership and handgun violence and also automatic weapon violence, as opposed to here in Pakistan, where we have been having problems with illegal gun ownership, but legal gun ownership is tightly regulated. People understand terrorist violence. They understand that kind of thing. They don't understand children taking up guns and going into the schools and shooting each other, shooting their classmates, shooting their teachers. That's unheard of. It doesn't happen here, and nobody can understand it.
With this already very fraught relationship between the U.S. and Pakistan, has one of Pakistan's own daughters getting killed in this very American tragedy, has that further eroded the U.S. in the eyes of Pakistanis?
I think it's just sort of reinforced the knowledge that the United States has some very serious social problems, and children picking up guns to come into schools and shooting their classmates and shooting their teachers is a very serious problem, but we're kind of relating it to our own problems with extremist violence. We're kind of saying you have your types of terrorism and we have ours. And it's just really a tragedy that one of our children got caught up with your kind of terrorism, with your kind of extremism. I think we're just trying to understand and comprehend that guns cause havoc no matter whose hands they are in.
I gather Sabiqa Sheikh's body is being flown back to her family in Pakistan early this week. What is the funeral likely to entail? What happens now?
Actually, there was already one funeral prayer in Houston, and it was widely attended by the Muslim community and by the friends of Sabiqa Sheikh and the host family that she stayed with. Once her body reaches Pakistan, there will be another funeral prayer, and then she'll be laid to rest in a graveyard.
Author Beena Shah in Karachi. Her new book is called Before She Sleeps. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
The date is set for June 12th, the location Singapore, and there's already a team on the ground making final preparations. I'm talking about a historic U.S.-North Korea summit. No sitting American president has ever met with a leader of North Korea. But in recent days, a highly anticipated meeting between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un has suddenly come into question. Victor Cha was George W. Bush's top advisor on North Korea. If he was advising this president, Cha says he would tell President Trump that he needs to stick with the game plan.
He wants to do this summit with the North Korean leader. And despite the hiccups that we saw last week with North Korean statements that they may not come to the meeting if they can't get agreement on what denuclearization is, these are bumps in the road that we should always expect with North Korea. It's never easy negotiating with them. Things that you think are agreed upon are later not agreed upon. And so no one should walk into this thinking that this is going to be, you know, smooth sailing or that there's going to be a fairy tale ending at the end of this. It's always going to be difficult, and you got to roll up your sleeves and expect all sorts of curveballs like we got last week.
So you said stick with the game plan, but what was the game plan?
Well, I mean, I think according to what we've seen from President Trump, the game plan was to do a high-level meeting to try to get assurances from the North Korean leader at the very highest levels about a commitment to denuclearization and then use that to get the two negotiating parties to then implement what the leaders did. It may sound a little bit idealistic or perhaps a little bit naive. But at the same time, you know, having participated in these negotiations for 30 years, we've been trying to do this without talking to the North Korean leader. And we finally have a U.S. president that was willing to break all sorts of policy conventions and try to do diplomacy personally. And if there's one country where the leader matters in terms of making decisions, it's North Korea.
The Washington Post has a story quoting an anonymous U.S. official saying about the North Koreans, it doesn't look like they want to denuclearize at all. What do you make of that?
Well, that would be consistent with statements that the North Koreans have been making through much of the previous 2 years, where they believe that their nuclear weapons program has been a success and that they, on December 12th, I think it was, of last year, they announced that they were now a successful nuclear weapons state. The North Korean game plan, I think, has always been that they wanted to achieve that capability and then be willing to negotiate a peace treaty or normalization of relations or even an arms control agreement with the United States on the Korean Peninsula, but as a nuclear weapon state. And so I think that, you know, the really difficult question on the U.S. side is whether you can accept something like that or whether you can accept it as the beginning negotiating premise and see if you can work the North Koreans further back from their position than what they've stated. And, you know, of course, that is what negotiations are for.
Right. I mean, so the North Koreans have kind of gotten what they want, and now the U.S. wants them to denuclearize. When you're bargaining, wanting something too much is a bad thing, and once the other party knows you want it bad, they're suddenly in a position of greater power. Is that what's going on here, in spite of Trump's reputation as the great deal maker?
I think to an extent that is. I mean, the way the president responded with every action that the North Koreans took, and they took, you know, some significant actions over the past few weeks where they agreed not to test anymore. They agreed to close down their nuclear test site. They said to the International Maritime Aviation and Aviation Organization that they would no longer conduct unannounced ballistic missile tests, and they returned the three American hostages. They took a number of steps, and President Trump really played those up, which had the impact of increasing expectations of this summit meeting. I think with the announcement by the North Koreans last week saying they may not come, now expectations all of a sudden have been dropped of this summit. And I think at this point, the president should probably stay quiet, should not tweet, and should focus on allowing Pompeo and his team to try to negotiate some real policy deliverables for the summit.
Now, tomorrow, South Korea's President Moon Jae-in is going to meet with Trump. What's that conversation going to sound like, do you think? Because Moon was, after all, the one who told Trump, hey, you can sit down with Kim Jong-un, we can make it happen. And now a lot of it looks to be in doubt.
Right. You know, so I think probably within the last 72 hours, what they had planned to do during this meeting has changed drastically. I think initially it was probably the idea that the South Korean president would help Trump prepare for his meeting with Kim. The North and the South Korean leaders on April 27th had lots of discussions about the U.S.-North Korea summit. But now with the KCNA statement from the North last week, President Moon is probably coming here very concerned and wanting to make sure he can salvage this meeting happening on June 12th if it's not postponed.
I mean, I guess we need to look on the bright side because averting a potential nuclear conflict has to be a good thing. But I guess what I want you to tell us is what could possibly go wrong?
The thing about doing summits like this at the very beginning is that if the summit fails, then you really have no place to go in terms of diplomacy. I mean, the summit is the top, right? It is the very pinnacle of diplomacy. And if it fails, the only thing after a summit is a cliff. So I don't think anybody wants that to happen. And if this meeting goes forward, and as we get closer to it, I think all sides will realize they have much more vested in a successful meeting, or at least one that doesn't fail. So I think in that sense, there's quite a bit at stake. And I think all sides realize that, but the North Koreans know that, and they will leverage that to their advantage in the days to come before June 12th.
Victor Cha at the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University, thanks very much for being with us today.
That's my pleasure.
Just ahead on the show, why farmers and truckers in Venezuela fear for their livelihoods and for their lives. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. It's now official. Nicolas Maduro has won another six-year term as president of Venezuela with 68% of the vote. Neither the win nor the percentage is really a surprise. Millions of voters boycotted the election, and critics of President Maduro say the whole thing was rigged. They point to a video of Maduro taking a victory lap in a mostly vacant plaza in Caracas. Patricia Laya is the Venezuela bureau chief for Bloomberg. She says that the boycott significantly decreased voter turnout.
The main opposition coalition called to boycott the vote. That's a reason why a large sector of the population decided to sit out yesterday's events. On the other hand, you have just a very dissatisfied, frustrated electorate who has to fight daily for everything from finding food to be able to afford anything that they do find. Inflation is set to reach 13,000% this year. It's so hard to live in an economy where everything increases in price every single day. You have a large section of the population that's worried about a lot of things other than showing up to vote.
So were polling stations empty? I mean, what did you see?
Yes. So we visited dozens of polling stations yesterday, and a lot of them in the more popular areas of Caracas. And in many of these cases, I was the only person there other than the people who were actually working at the polling stations. And it just tells you that people are just really frustrated.
There's this really odd video that's been making the rounds on Twitter. You may have seen it. Maduro is celebrating his victory and waving to a crowd, but there is no crowd. It does kind of echo what you saw in those voting stations where there wasn't anybody at times. Did Maduro or any government officials acknowledge the boycott?
Well, they did. Maduro even last night said that even if there had been no boycott, he would have still won. So he seems very certain of his popularity. It seems like the only thing that Venezuelans and Chavistas agree on now is that they didn't show up to vote. We'll have to see where they can take it from here.
Now, Maduro's main challenger was former Governor Henry Falcon. Does he have any plans to challenge the results of the election?
Well, he even came on TV before the results were announced and said he didn't recognize the election as legitimate. He denounced some of the government's tactics of offering voters some sort of gifts or bonuses for voting. But all these things we knew would happen and have been happening in Venezuela for years. So this cannot have been a surprise for Falcon. And yesterday night, he mentioned that he wanted to have the elections again later in the year if there were going to be fair conditions. But, you know, it's fair to say that I think a lot of people are disappointed in Falcon and think of him as sort of naive or innocent for having thought that these would be elections that will be held in fair conditions.
I mean, even before the elections this past weekend, the U.S. and several other countries in the region were calling for Maduro to suspend the elections. So now what? Will Venezuela be facing more oil sanctions?
We woke up today to a flurry of threats and sanctions from all over the world. Germany, Chile. We know that Venezuela is under active review by the U.S. for oil sanctions. Trump is supposed to make an announcement that could include some sort of warning or hint of oil sanctions, which would definitely be sort of a deathly blow for Venezuela's already collapsing economy.
Bloomberg's Patricia Laya there in Caracas. In the last month alone, there have been dozens of protests in Venezuela, all about the shortage of food. And that's making life and work hazardous for those who grow and deliver food in the country. Mariana Zuniga reports from Caracas.
After 10 hours on the road, Gregorio Piñanco reaches Caracas. It's 6 a.m. He gets out of the truck, rubs the fatigue out of his eyes, and starts unloading his precious merchandise. Food, specifically 6,000 pounds of white Guayanese cheese.
Hoy, por lo menos, hoy ha sido un día fatal.
Today was a terrible day, Piñanco says. The road was blocked and people tried to loot our truck. Transporting food in Venezuela is dangerous business these days. As prices surge, amid a crippling economic crisis, hunger is pushing some people to attack delivery trucks.
Peligroso. Super peligroso y...
It's extremely dangerous. The situation has been terrible since food began to get scarce several years ago. We know that hungry people will go out in search of something. Even if you're not a criminal, you have to find a way to eat.
Looters use tree trunks to block the highway, rocks to stop trucks, and shards of metal to puncture tires. Just a few months ago, while driving through the central town of Barquisimeto, Piñanco says a man hurled a rock through his windshield. Then, more than 30 people climb onto his truck.
En Barquisimeto,
People tried to loot my truck. I was able to escape, but they damaged the whole truck. They smashed out all the windows. My partner was seriously wounded in the head. Thank God we survived.
Due to the increase in violence on the roads, truckers have started traveling in convoys. They flash their lights to signal potential trouble, and they drive as much as possible during daylight hours. But even when they're lucky and avoid attacks, they still have to deal with another hazard: police and soldiers who often demand bribes at military checkpoints.
Nowadays, we're used to them, so we just cooperate. If we have cheese, we give them a little. We always try to give them a little something. If you arrive with empty hands, they start looking for a way to mess with you.
Transporting food isn't the only perilous job in Venezuela. Producing it has become dangerous too. Cattle ranchers say farms are constantly being raided by people who steal and slaughter their cows.
The issue of cattle rustling isn't new, but we haven't seen anything like we're seeing now.
This is Chara Melgarejo. He's a rancher in Apure State, and he says cattle rustling has become a daily occurrence.
In the past few days, it's happened twice to me. This year, I lost 83 animals out of 800. That is a very alarming amount.
Due to the insecurity, producers no longer want to go to their farms.
If we go, we do it quickly. Every week, at least in my town, people die in confrontation between thieves and ranch hands.
Melgarejo says this all comes on top of the payments he has to make to the regional government. In some states, the government takes a percentage of their production.
They confiscate half our animals, and when we produce cheese, they confiscate 10% of it, which means we have to increase our prices, even on the cheapest products, like white cheese. If we refuse to give them that percentage, the government has threatened to seize our farms.
Back in Caracas, Piñanco unloads his truck filled with cheese. He has a brief break, and then he'll take to the road again in 3 days. He says every time he starts a new trip, he knows he's risking his life. Quitting have crossed his mind, but he can't afford to be unemployed right now.
I'm scared. Sometimes I've wanted to quit, but I go to my house and see my family, and I wonder, how would we survive? I have to keep going. Let's see what happens after the elections. Let's see if this situation changes.
For The World, Mariana Zúñiga, Caracas.
I'm Marco Werman. An Egyptian soccer star becomes a fan favorite in England and challenges stereotypes in the process.
He's not the bogeyman. You know, he's just a normal guy, and he is Muslim, and his faith comes through. So it's just really nice that there's a real sense of community amongst the people that are supporting him.
Love for Mo Salah still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. If you, like me, tuned in to watch Prince Harry and Meghan Markle tie the knot at Windsor Castle this weekend, you probably noticed what this person noticed.
There was so much of African-American culture in it.
That's Bonnie Greer. She's an African-American playwright and author, originally from Chicago. For nearly half of her life, about 30 years, she's been living in London. That's where we reached her earlier today. She told us what it felt like to see African-American culture so deeply a part of the royal wedding, from an African-American minister to a black gospel choir.
Oprah Winfrey's hat stood out for me the most, because it was a real proper black church lady's hat, which I thought was great.
Did you feel a sense of pride watching this on Saturday in any way?
I felt proud of the singing. I felt proud of the preaching. I felt proud of her mother and Meghan, too, because this is a big job. And I was proud of the Queen and the Prince of Wales, Harry's father, because they allowed it to happen. It wouldn't have happened if they didn't allow it. So I was proud of them doing that and also making a statement to their country, because they would know almost better than anybody how the country ticks.
Do you think that Black British also felt a sense of pride?
I think people were happy. You know, it was a happy thing, but it was not, it was African American. And it will, you know, you always have to be careful here because in the hierarchy of things, African Americans are Americans and Americans are powerful and Americans are on the top. So you have to be very, very careful that that isn't foregrounded and made to seem better, because what people do is they tend to pit people, you know, people, communities of color of African descent against one another. That's one of the things racially tinged societies do.
From your own personal experience, how do you think the Black American identity differs from the Black British identity?
Well, the difference is this. Black British people have a literal and tangible home. When I first got here in the 80s, I realized that people were talking about home, and they were talking about a particular place that had a particular identity. So, you know, you can talk about Jamaica, you can talk about Barbados, you can talk about Sierra Leone, you can talk about Kenya, you can talk about Zimbabwe, you can talk about these places. And as an African American, you can only talk about Chicago, where I'm from, or LA, where Megan is from, or Boston. And these places are America. It's one place. So that, in fact, your links with Africa, with this side of Blackness, is very, very far away. I mean, compared to Black British people. So it's a big, big cultural shift.
Do you think Meghan Markle has been embraced by the Black British communities? And will that happen if it hasn't happened yet?
You know, of course, they identify with her because she is a woman of African descent. But, you know, at the end of the day, people will say, well, she's American, because she is. And the people who will be disgruntled with her will use that as an excuse. So, you know, those of us who've been here a long time and understand this culture, hopefully she'll be able to, hook up with some of us so that she can avoid some of these pitfalls, because they're there.
So do you see some of the commentary coming from both the U.S. and the U.K. celebrating this wedding as a sign of progress and potential change when it comes to race relations in the U.K.? Do you think that's overblown?
Totally. I mean, again, I want to go back to saying something very important, and I think a lot of Americans overlook. This is a different culture from the United States. This is a different world. And I think for you find out, I mean, the first time I'd ever heard myself called an American was in this country. And it took me a long time to understand what that meant, because, of course, in the United States, I'm not called an American. But in Britain, I'm called an American. And I had to actually reconcile what that meant for me, because my half my life has been here. Part of it is because I didn't want to get rid of my accent. I didn't want to get rid of my voice. And so that sort of nails you and narrows you in many ways. So, you know, this is going to be a hard row for her to hoe.
In the lead up to the wedding, there was a lot of attention to Meghan Markle being biracial. But did you expect to see the sort of conversation we're now having about race?
Well, it would be that way, you know, because she has an African American root. So it would be that way. And it's never happened before. So, that's sort of, you know, human. That's a human thing. And it allows us all to sort of talk about that issue and that reality in the context of the most high profile family on earth. So it's very human to do that. And it makes perfect sense.
What is the best that you would kind of hope for Meghan Markle now, like her role and what she would be doing?
Well, I hope that she's able to speak as she would like to speak. I hope that she gets the support from Harry, which I'm sure she will, and the family, because their family is not famous for supporting outsiders, and that they understand that maybe she will need some special support. And I hope that she's protected from the press, because the press here is very virulent.
What would be your one piece, first piece of advice if you were to sit down with Meghan Markle about being a subject in the UK?
I would tell her to listen. I would tell her to go on a listening tour and just sit down and listen. Just listen to people talk, listen to what they tell her, listen and look at how people live. And that's all I would do. I wouldn't provide any solutions or remedies or anything. I would just spend the next 3 or 4 months just visiting places and coming in and eating with people and just seeing, you know, what's going down. And that's what I would do.
Bonnie Greer is an American-British playwright and commentator. She's been speaking with us from London. Bonnie, thanks very much for your time today.
And thank you, and great to be with you.
You might have heard that Prince Harry and Meghan Markle, now the Duke and Duchess of Sussex, ask guests to donate to certain charities instead of giving wedding presents. Well, here's a detail about the royal wedding that you probably didn't know. One of those charities is the Mena Mahila Foundation in India. It works to give Indian women access to menstrual hygiene products and to dispel the stigma around periods. My BBC colleague Yogita LeMay reports from Mumbai.
I'm in Govandi, which is an area on the outskirts of Mumbai. It's perhaps one of the poorest parts of the city. There's a big slum here. Just behind it is a massive garbage dump. But I've come here to visit the Mena Mahila Foundation. This is one of the charities that's been chosen by Prince Harry and Meghan Markle. So when people want to give gifts for their wedding, they can donate to this charity and 6 others. This is the only foreign one that's been chosen. Its office is on the ground floor of a 7-story building where a lot of people who've been rehabilitated from the slums live. And I'm just going to step inside it now and meet the founder. Hi, Suhani.
Hi, nice how you good? Nice to meet you.
Suhani Jalota is the founder of the charity. She's 23 years old and set up Mena Mahila Foundation 3 years ago. They make low-cost sanitary pads and encourage more conversations about menstruation, which is still a taboo topic in India.
In the country today, there are about 320 million women that don't have access to sanitary products. We want women to talk about issues such as menstrual hygiene openly. The women that we employ here have never gone to school or have gone to school and have dropped out. And now these women are talking in public about sanitary napkins to more than 2,000 women every month.
One of the rooms at the office has been converted into a workshop. Half a dozen women are making sanitary towels there, taking compressed cotton pads and then processing them further. They make about 1,000 a day. The women live in the slums around the office. Last year, Meghan Markle visited the foundation and saw the work they do. Ms. Jalota says she wasn't expecting to be on the list of charities chosen by the royal couple.
We were definitely very surprised, but we were happy that she really kept her word, that she would support us in any way that she could. We can now go to many more communities, speak to many more women, and we feel confident about what we're saying. It's kind of as a validation.
I've come along with 2 women from the Mena Mahila Foundation to an area where they distribute and sell their sanitary pads. It's a big slum that's right next to a canal that looks more like a sewer line, inky, muddy water with bits of plastic floating on it. Smells very bad as well. And I'm now walking through the alleys of the slum with them. And we've now just stopped at one of the houses where some of the sanitary packs need to be delivered.
Last month, yahan pe koi aurat aayi thi ki Mena Mahila.
Archana Amre has been with the foundation since it started. She tells me how tough their jobs are.
Many people bang the door in our faces. If there are men around, the women don't talk to us. But since the royal wedding news, more people recognize us. They recognize our brand.
Archana Amre with the Mena Mahila Foundation in Mumbai, ending that report from the BBC's Yogita LeMay. Our next story is about a superstar named Mo Salah. You've never heard of him? Well, he might be the most famous soccer player in the UK right now. Salah's Egyptian, but plays for Liverpool, and he scored a record amount of goals this season. He's so popular that his mint green cleats are on display at the British Museum's Egypt collection. After each goal, Salah's knelt down in prayer in a public display of his Muslim faith, which has led to chants like this.
It's good enough for me. It's good enough for two. And I'll be Muslim too.
Mo Salah, if he's good enough for you, he's good enough for me. If he scores another few, then I'll be Muslim too. Rabia Limbada is a Mo Salah fan and a journalist for our partners at the BBC World Service. So I'm a little surprised by this, Rabia, because wasn't there controversy a few years ago when some Muslim Liverpool fans were pictured worshiping during halftime and another fan posted a photo of them calling them a disgrace? So is this for real? Or are things changing?
I don't know. I remember that issue really well. But, you know, I'd like to think that we've moved on. I like to think that it's a little bit more common now to see people praying in the middle of the afternoon. I mean, I have lots of friends who are from Liverpool, who are big Liverpool fans, and they've said to me that there's a real kind of sense that people and supporters and fans of the club have really taken Mo Salah to their hearts. They really love the fact that he's so kind of openly Muslim, and he's not the bogeyman. You know, he's just a normal guy, and he is Muslim, and his faith comes through. So it's just really nice that there's a real sense of inclusivity. There's a real sense of community amongst the people that are supporting him. It's a really lovely thing to see.
I know you're a Mo Salah fan. What happens at your house when your family sits down to watch a Liverpool match and Mo Salah scores? What does that all look like?
It's quite mad. It's been a bit crazy. My children are very young. They're 6 and 8. My husband has been a lifelong Liverpool fan. So obviously when the kids came along, it was kind of inevitable. Both the kids and my husband, they follow Mo Salah, and they get very, very excited when he scores, and they get very, very excited when he's got the ball, and there's a real kind of anticipation.
When you say things are quite mad at your house, that's like the British sense of mad. Like it goes absolutely crazy. That's what that means, right?
not quite. We're quite a reserved bunch as Brits. But yeah, there's lots of cheering and there's lots of excitement. And actually, for the first time in a very long time, all three of them, so my husband, my son and my daughter, all have matching red Liverpool home tops. And my husband and my son both have Salah on the back of theirs now. And my daughter has her name because she's quite an individual. She likes to set herself apart.
Do you have any Mo Salah pictures on your mobile phone? Any screensavers? Any pictures on your desk?
No, I don't. And I think my husband may have a thing or two to say about that if I did.
Personally, what has Mo Salah meant to you?
Do you know what? It's just really, really lovely to have someone who is at the top of their game, who is unapologetically Muslim, who is, it sounds like, a thoroughly decent guy, who is universally loved, not just for the way in which he plays football, but also the way in which he conducts himself. He just seems to be the kind of person that exemplifies everything it is to be about a Muslim. You know, all the good stuff, all the really lovely, kind, generous, considerate, all the things that you don't often read about. And it's just so lovely to see. And, you know, he's an exceptional football player to boot. It's quite a lovely, wholesome thing.
So, Rabia, Mo Salah carried his team, Liverpool, to its first Champions League final in over a decade. Where are you going to watch the match this coming weekend?
We are going to be watching it at home. The only thing I'm worried about is my children are really, really small and they do go to bed at 9 o'clock. So I've said that they
might
can
need to cut
up
them a little slack this weekend.
Yeah, well, I've said they can stay up and watch all of it.
Mo Salah fan Rabia Limbada, also a journalist for the BBC. Thanks very much for being with us, telling us about your love for Mo Salah.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Before we take a short break, there's time for a quick note about a story we're working on for tomorrow's show. There's a museum tucked away in a refugee camp in Lebanon. It's got clay pots, glass lanterns, walking sticks, ordinary stuff. But for some Palestinians, those old household items are treasures.
I cannot describe the feeling. You're looking at things from Palestine and you cannot even go to Palestine. It makes you very happy, but also it's very painful for your heart.
It's the Museum of Palestinian Memories, tomorrow, right here on the show. A lot of the stories we've had on the show today deal with issues of identity. So does this final one. Just a month ago, Junot Diaz was on a pedestal, widely considered one of the best fiction writers in the U.S. His work treasured by many because of the way it highlighted the complexity of Latino identity in America, based in part on Diaz's own Dominican background. Then several women came forward accusing Junot Diaz of abusive behavior towards them, and now he's off that pedestal. Many people have been giving this a lot of thought recently. Monica Castillo is a writer with The Washington Post. So before all of this happened, all of these allegations, what did Junot Diaz represent to you?
Oh, my goodness. I looked up to Junot Diaz. He was one of the first people that I read that used Spanglish in such a way that reminded me of the language that I spoke in my house, which is a mix of English and Spanish. And it just goes whichever which way. There's slang. There's made up words used, you know, references to stuff from back home to, you know, we're giving new names to things in America. So I felt seen for the very first time. I felt like I could relate to some of these characters, that I knew some of these characters.
I mean, you wrote in the Washington Post that Junot Diaz is almost like your tío, your uncle. Can you just explain what that fully means?
It's like an emotional connection when you see someone from your community excel in such this public way, and you're so proud of them. You kind of take like a little bit of ownership, like, oh yeah, you know, he's one of us. You know, I looked up to him as a writer. I really treasured his books and made me feel that I, too, could be in this space, that I can write and use the words that mean a lot to me. And I don't have to divide myself away from my identity in order to become a writer. And then it was very hard to hear the news that came out earlier this month.
Let me just go back and build a little context here for where we're at today with Junot Diaz. It started a couple of weeks ago with the author Zinzi Clemens confronting him at a writer's conference in Sydney, Australia, about something that happened when she was 26. She said Diaz forcibly kissed her when she was a grad student. She also tweeted about the incident. And then the author Carmen Maria Machado wrote her own Twitter thread about how Diaz verbally attacked her when she asked him a question in a Q&A. I mean, he does come across as a bully, and the reaction has been intense. He stepped down as a Pulitzer Prize chairman, pulled out of the Writers Festival, being investigated by his employer at MIT. How differently did these allegations make you see Diaz?
Very differently. He talks a lot about sort of like machismo culture in his books. Some of his characters could be described as abusive or manipulative of the women that they're with and in their relationships with other people. But I never thought that that was a reason like we shouldn't talk about these flaws, or we shouldn't talk about the fact that that machismo culture is prevalent in Latino communities, and that sometimes the men that we love and the fathers that we look up to and the uncles and tios that we treasure do have these problems and they have to be talked about. But to find out that he was also a perpetrator, not just bringing it up for the sake of conversation, was very disheartening.
How awkward or conflicted about the whole incident do you feel as a Latin American writer who's also a woman?
Oh, very conflicted. But that was one of the things that I decided I needed to find some way to deal with it that was positive and not just mourning this loss of a hero. So I reached out to Twitter and just started throwing out titles from other Latina writers. Like, you know, we're also in this space. We may not get the same sort of attention and we may not get the same sort of, you know, fanfare every time a book of ours comes out. But we are here and we are doing the work. And within a few days, I had over 200 book recommendations from playwrights, poets, romantic writers, sci-fi to young adult fiction, all kinds of stuff that I never even knew existed out there. So that was actually really nice to be able to shift my focus over to something more positive.
What do you want your message to be to other writers right now?
Oh, that's a good question. I have many thoughts when this situation comes up to mind, one of which is as a woman and as someone who has, you know, gone through intimidation and felt unsafe in her field from time to time, I wish that this act of we're going to keep talking about this and we're going to be opened and we're going to receive these stories to remain. I'm worried about the backlash against some of these women. And even in that Twitter thread that I mentioned before, I got pushback from other people who said that I was turning my back on my community. And that's not at all where my mind was at when I asked to focus on Latino women's work. So I think the big thing is I want us to be able to keep listening to each other.
I mean, one thing that I'm hearing is that so much weight has been put on Juno Diaz to be the writer who represented Latino communities, that now with these allegations, it's almost like there's no one else to represent. But surely there have to be. So do we blame publishers, academics, readers, Latinas who put Diaz on a pedestal? Who's at fault here?
Well, I think it's a bit more systemic, and a lot of that comes from who's in the position of power, who picks the titles that gets published, who decides on which books to market and how much they're going to market, who gets the book tour, who gets the residencies, who gets all the attention, and then becomes the de facto voice of a community. I think that sort of phenomenon is called tokenism, where it's just you have one name and that's it. We're all done with diversity here. We're all equal. We're all set. And for so many people that I talked to, Juno Diaz, for the longest time, was the only Latino writer that they could name. And that's just so limiting when you realize that there's over 26 odd countries in Latin America, and not to mention millions of U.S. born Latinos. And now there's only one guy who can speak for all of us. That really limits the number of stories that can get out there.
So is this a moment to lift up other writers?
This is a moment to lift up other writers, certainly. And it's a moment to also look at the way that publishing kind of focuses all its attention to one. There can only be one creative from this field. I mean, we're also kind of seeing this among Native American writers and the sort of reconciling with Sherman Alexie, who also had sexual misconduct allegations made about him. And now there's teachers asking, well, I don't know who else to, you know, list on my syllabus because Sherman Alexie and Juno Diaz were the only ones that I knew. But there's so many other books. There's so many other writers out there. And so I would just encourage people to search and to look, because there's so many more stories from our communities that have just not been heard.
Monica Castillo with The Washington Post, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
You can find a list of Monica Castillo's favorite Latino authors on our Facebook page. Just go to Facebook and search for The World. And while you're there, we'd love to hear about your favorites. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.